Welcome to the Far Middle. This is the voice of your host, Nick DeOlias, and I hope that you are well. We're at episode 196 of the Far Middle, and our sports dedication for this episode is going to speak to a meeting for the first time of two legendary greats, two giants in the sport of basketball. Now, one giant was I'm speaking of figuratively, but the other giant I'm speaking of figuratively as well as literally. And these are also two prior Far Middle sports dedication subjects. You can probably tell by now, if you've been listening to this podcast long enough, that I'm fascinated about the early history of the NBA. Just great stories there and a lot of stories that translate beyond basketball and sport. Now, the former giant that I'm speaking of is the Celtics coach, Red Auerbach. And the latter giant was the indeed giant, then 6'11", legendary center, Wilt Chamberlain. I believe this meeting occurred in the summer of 1954, and I am more certain where it occurred. It was at a country club resort in Monticello, New York, in the Catskills during the summer, where Chamberlain worked as a nearly 7 foot tall high schooler from the Philly area. Now, he wasn't just there to work and make some extra money and tips as a bellhop. He was there also to play basketball in the summer league and on that team that the country club sponsored and that, interestingly, Red Auerbach coached. Now, Red at the time was just starting his career trajectory as well. In Red Auerbach's biography, he gives a great and a fascinating summary of what those first encounters that summer were like. The coach had heard quite a bit about the already famous high school player, and he admitted that after just a few minutes of watching Chamberlain on an outdoor court at that country club, he just knew that he was looking at a high schooler who was a cinch to become one of the greats and perhaps the greatest ever in the pro circuit. Now, Wilt had all the tools, and he was the strongest player Coach Red had ever seen. And that remained true through Chamberlain's pro career. But there was a problem with Chamberlain from the coach's perspective. Although he was young, Wilt was headstrong, and he was overly confident in his own abilities to the point where he resisted coaching input. And he didn't like to be told what to do, and he knew full well of his own ability. And Coach Auerbach would tutor him on how to play more effective defense that summer, and Wilt would shrug off the advice. Now, this was before Auerbach became a legend in his own right with all those titles and with the Celtics. So you can sort of understand why Chamberlain didn't pay him due respect, at least immediately. And Chamberlain, as I said, he was already the most highly acclaimed high school player in history, and he was a celebrity even at that young age. Now, what helped the two future greats come to a meeting of the minds was a game where Chamberlain was guarding an experienced player who scored easily on him in the first half. It embarrassed Chamberlain in the locker room at the half, and the coach for the first time sensed some humility from the player. Second half of that game was a totally different story once Wilt made the adjustments that his coach advised. And it wasn't, by the way, just Red's advice. Chamberlain, he had great basketball instincts. He was a very smart player. So he would quickly adapt once he figured out and saw where the flaws were in his defense. But the two of them probably got there quicker. Now, Red wanted to sign Chamberlain as a Celtic. A lot of people don't realize that, but it wasn't meant to be. And fortunately for the Celtics and for Red, they were able to sign a player by the name of Bill Russell instead. And Bill Russell helped hang more than a few banners from the rafters of the Boston Garden. And Chamberlain, of course, went on to NBA greatness with Philadelphia and Los Angeles. But, you know, he largely came up short across his career. Is that an ironic pun of the giant Chamberlain coming up short? At least when he squared up against the Celtics and Russell. A cool story of how two NBA legends first met that summer in the early 1950s, before they were both legends, but when they were both on the rise, and also an interesting what if, or what might have been if Coach Red was successful in signing player Wilt to the Celtics. Some sports history and intrigue for the Far Middle dedication of episode 196. Let's make our first connection for the week going from the what if that we discussed in basketball lore to a what if facing the new administration in Washington. What if this administration is indeed serious about getting government's fiscal house in order? There's been much talk with the new administration discussing ways to make government more efficient and to reduce government spending and to close the budget deficit. And on top of those discussions, there's also the debate about tax policy. And you start to see how complicated we can make what is in the end a very simple issue become. And that issue, of course, is a sustainable and a balanced budget for government. The levers in the end are indeed simple. You can raise taxes to increase revenues. That's one option. You can cut spending by government. There's a second one. Or you can scale back entitlements. And each lever, although simple, brings to bear many complexities and endless policy debates. But there is an additional lever that is almost always overlooked that bears much more attention in these times. And that's the lever that I want to discuss. A person who did not overlook this lever was the great Thomas Sowell, one of the ideological and spiritual beacons of the far middle, author, thought leader, shining light. And he recently wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal right after Christmas last year. And in it, he identified a critical lever that could largely avoid the need for additional taxes and for scaling back entitlements while still managing to create a sustainable and balanced budget for the federal government. That additional lever that he identified was the sale of land that the federal government currently owns and controls to the private sector. Now, check out the scale of this asset that sits on the federal balance sheet. It blew my mind. The federal government owns an unbelievable amount of land. Granted, some of it is dedicated to necessities such as military bases, but most of it is not. The land owned by the National Park Service alone is larger than Italy. The land owned by the Fish and Wildlife Service is larger than Germany. The land owned by the Forest Service, it's larger than Britain and Spain combined. And the land owned by the Bureau of Land Management, it's larger than Japan, North Korea, South Korea, and the Philippines combined. The government selling land, by the way, it's not a new idea. Land sales by the federal government were a significant source of government income before there was an income tax, and that income tax was created in the early 1900s. And then the Reagan administration brought the idea back to life, but it faced some serious political opposition at the time, really didn't go anywhere. The Commerce Department, a few years ago, specifically in 2015, they placed the value of government-owned lands at $1.8 trillion. So now you start to see how land sales can make a substantial difference in our path toward a sustainable federal government budget, especially if you couple it with increased government efficiency and scaled back government regulation and reduced government spending. And I suspect that the Commerce Department estimate that $1.8 trillion for the federally owned land, it's very conservative. I think the actual value is much higher than that. And don't forget about what it costs the government to take care of and maintain all that land. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, says that wildfires on land managed by the federal government, 5 times the size of wildfires on non-federal lands. So the government isn't necessarily a great steward of that land, and our government expends tremendous amounts of money maintaining that land. Selling it to the private sector and to private citizens who would not just raise money to pay down the debt and balance the budget, but would also help reduce government spending because of the maintenance costs associated with that land, it begins to make a tremendous amount of sense. And land transferred from the government to the private sector, that's going to spur additional investment. It's going to grow GDP. It's going to increase jobs in the private sector, and it's going to increase affordable housing. All of those things will increase tax revenues to the federal government, providing yet an additional budgetary boost. Yes, when you add it all up, constant listeners, our federal government owns over 1/4 of the total land area of the United States. And when you look at the data and you apply logic, that doesn't make much sense to taxpayers and to citizens. There's no time to act like the present, considering our current government financial mess. Thomas Sowell might have given us an idea from a prior time whose time has come once again. After talking over the statistics of U.S. government-owned land, let's make a connection to an interesting contradiction in the United States, one backed by its own set of statistics. Centuries of religious freedom in America have led, ironically, to a loss of interest in practicing religion by Americans. And 2 studies from last year point this out. I wanted to share them with you. The first was from our friends at Gallup poll. They reported that 56% of Americans seldom or never attend a religious service, and only 21% go weekly. Now, there's similar non-attendance numbers for non-Christians, whether they be Jews, Muslims, or Hindus. And there was one exception of a specific religious demographic, which was for Mormons. The second study was from the Public Religion Research Institute. It found that 25% of Americans self-identify as religiously unaffiliated, which is a significant increase from 10 years earlier. White Catholics and white Protestants, they show the highest loss rates from their denominations. And then how about exit polls from the 2024 presidential election? This was really interesting. 71% of voters who reported having no religion voted for Vice President Harris. And then Fox News reported that 61% of people who never go to church voted for Vice President Harris. And of those who attended church at least once a week, 65% voted for President Trump. Those are some interesting statistics when you look at different demographics. So I thought these polls and statistics were incredibly interesting, and they show trends that I would not have anticipated the level of degree of, which is why I wanted to share them with you. Let's quickly jump from the question of how Americans' religious convictions are morphing to another question to ponder. Where has inflation hit Americans the hardest in the past 4 years? I've got data measuring inflation and prices and costs from January 2021 through November 2024. Listen to some of these categories. Car insurance, it's up 57%. Airline fares are up 34%. Gasoline's up 32%, while electricity is up 28%. Not surprisingly, food has become more expensive. Bakery products are up 27%. Meat, fish, and eggs, they're up 25%. Shelter's gotten more expensive. It's up 24% over that period of time. It costs more to drink things. Coffee is up 23%, while non-alcoholic beverages, they're up 23% as well. Used cars and used trucks, they're up 20%. So for those elite economists and politicians and anyone out there who thinks that inflation isn't significant and it wasn't real the past 4 years, read the statistics and weep. One popular remedy offered by the left that you always hear to address inflation serves as our next connection, which is having government fixed price controls, even though that has failed every single time it's been attempted across the globe. But you can rest assured that leftist or progressive politicians and bureaucrats will keep going to that well and pointing to it as the answer to inflationary times, which is ironic considering that inflation is almost always caused by a progressive government and its monetary policies. Anyway, there was a great essay published last year titled The Dangers of Price Controls, and it was by Hazlitt and Westbury, and they had some really interesting observations. The most important thing that they pointed out, I believe, was that price and wage fixing is harmful at any time and under any circumstances. Movement toward a dictated and authoritarian economy, it's never a good thing. It tries to make illogical arrangements that both sides in a transaction would never be willing to agree to, but for the government coercion. It nullifies contracts that have already been made in good faith and at arm's length. An example would be where a company wants to grant a pay raise to a deserving worker. That move would be forbidden under new regulations that would fix wages and/or prices. It takes freedom away from the individual business entity and worker and places power in the hands of government. Bad move under any circumstance. And price controls are never a cure for inflation, despite how they are marketed. All of it is an attempt to redirect the blame for inflation away from government and onto the private sector. If you want to look to the root causes of inflation today, look no further than government spending and government monetary policy to finance that spending. Since the pandemic, about $5 trillion of new debt was issued by government to effectively pay for programs that allowed people not to work and to fund climate policies, taking the definition of wasteful spending to new levels, or should I say, new depths. And you often hear academics and bureaucrats and certain think tanks talk as if it would be even possible to have price fixing across a complex economy like ours and to have it be done in an efficient manner. That's a joke. It would be impossible to do so for anyone, especially for government. Think of the complexity of the math. First, nobody knows for certain how many discrete prices and wages there are in our complex economy. Millions upon millions for certain. If you try to fix, say, 10 million prices, then you're also trying to fix something of the magnitude of tens of trillions of cross relationships of prices. Government can't do that because no one can do that. And that also means the government can't manage or police it. The impossibility and complexity of that task makes it silly to even attempt. Yet the chatter to do so continues to this day. And the proposed way of going about the fool's errand would be to create a group of boards or experts that would look over and decide price and wage controls. They would use their expert discretion, but we know what happens when you put such a hugely impactful degree of discretion into the hands of unelected and unaccountable bureaucrats. And there are some lessons as to how this quickly turns into a debacle that were from not that far long ago. The Nixon administration gave this a go in the 1970s. The pay board at the time announced a 5.5% wage increase in November of 1970, but less than 2 weeks later, that same pay board ratified a wage increase in the coal industry, and it was almost 17%. And then less than a month later, that same pay board awarded railroad signalmen a 46% increase over less than a four-year period. It works out to an annual rate of about 13%. Yeah, government attempts the impossible, and when they do that, and then they institute a bureaucratic board to administer it, you get these types of erratic and contradictory decisions coming one after another. Think about what that might look like today, and how political and ideological favoritism would rear their heads over and over on every decision affecting everyone in our economy. No, constant listeners, if government wants to fight inflation and if it wants lower prices, it should free up and encourage the doers of our society and economy, and not by throwing more control and regulation upon them in the form of price controls. By the way, I mentioned monetary policy being one of the two root causes of our current inflationary journey the past 4 years. That was in addition to the government spending. Well, consider that the Federal Reserve has added 60% to the monetary supply and grew its balance sheet by 85% in just 16 years. The Federal Reserve was founded in 1913, about the same time income tax was instituted, referencing back to that Thomas Sowell piece on land sales by the federal government that we just discussed. In the 95 years between 1913, when the Federal Reserve was founded, and 2008, which spans a period of time from the creation of the Fed to the global financial crisis, just 40% of the money supply was created. But in the 16 years since 2008, we have tripled the money supply. There is the root cause of inflation. Oh, and one last reason not to want government to control prices and wages. Back in the early 1970s, the executive secretary of the Cost of Living Council, and you can imagine the bureaucratic beast that that must have been, explained the key to enforcing government-instituted prices and wages when he said, "The citizen's role in this program is to rat on his neighbor if his neighbor violated the controls." And you thought George Orwell was fiction. 1984 is closer to reality than you think if citizens don't remain vigilant on government excess. Speaking of fiction, let's close out this episode with a final connection to the greatest name in science fiction writing and film screenwriting that you never heard of. This was a female trailblazer in a male-dominated industry to boot. Yet I am confident you constant listeners know her work very well. It's amazing she remains relatively unknown. Her name is Lee Brackett. Born in 1915, she passed away in the 1970s. She had the nickname the Queen of Space Opera, as in a science fiction version of soap opera, and she was one of the most prominent female writers during the golden age of science fiction. As a screenwriter, she was best known for her collaborations with director Howard Hawks, mainly writing westerns and crime films. Now, on her science fiction writing side of her career, almost all of her stories were planetary romances that took place in the solar system, mainly Mars and Venus. She sort of portrayed Mars as marginally habitable, more of a desert type of a world, and it was populated by ancient and mostly humanoid races, whereas Venus was primitive, wet jungle type of a planet occupied by very aggressive tribes and reptilian monsters. And a prominent theme of her stories is the clash of planetary civilizations, how she was able to criticize the effects of colonialism on civilizations. They're either older or younger than those of the colonizers. And her heroes were always looking to set out to remake entire worlds according to their own codes. And those heroes were often at the mercy of trends and movements that were way bigger than they were. Now, I haven't read any of her sci-fi short stories or novels, but I and you have certainly seen her movies. Shortly after Brackett broke into science fiction writing, she wrote her first screenplays. Hollywood director, as I said, Howard Hawks, was a legend in his own right, and he was so impressed by her novels that he had his secretary call in this guy Brackett, because he thought that she was a man. Her name again was Lee, and the industry was dominated by men at the time. And he wanted to have her help another writer co-write a script for The Big Sleep. This was in the mid-1940s, which was a great film. Hawks didn't realize that she was a woman. Brackett didn't mind, and the film was co-written by Brackett, and that movie starred Humphrey Bogart. Again, it's classic cinema, as is all Bogart. Now, after she got married, she took a break from screenwriting. When she returned to screenwriting in the mid-1950s, she wrote a lot for TV and for movies. Howard Hawks hired her again, this time to write or co-write several John Wayne pictures, including Rio Bravo, which is classic Western. And by the way, that movie also starred Ricky Nelson, who we discussed with his Garden Party song at the end of episode 180, I believe. And because of her background with crime story writing, she later adapted Raymond Chandler's novel, The Long Goodbye, for the big screen. But her biggest film contribution wasn't a Western, and it wasn't a crime novel or a crime movie. It was back to her core genre of science fiction and adventure. She co-wrote what became one of the most widely viewed films ever, and part of one of the most profitable film franchises ever. And I believe she did not receive her due for her contribution in that endeavor. You see, Brackett worked on the screenplay for The Empire Strikes Back, which of course is the first Star Wars sequel. That script was at the time a big departure for Brackett, because up until then, all her science fiction had been in the form of novels and short stories. George Lucas said that he asked her to write a screenplay based on his story outline. She wrote a finished first draft titled Star Wars Sequel. That was delivered to Lucas shortly before her death from cancer in 1978. Unfortunately, she never got to see the final product. Her version, it was changed, heavily edited by Lucas. He wrote two additional drafts of the new screenplay. He reworked some of the dialogue. And while many say that her contributions or some of those details that she had in the story for Empire were changed, the basic story that she wrote, it's the same as the final movie plot. Brackett was credited for the final screenplay. She was also credited in tribute, despite not being involved in the final film, which I believe is more than fitting. Now, in the Brackett version, or in her draft, there's some differences from what you see in the movie. There is a love triangle between Luke, Leia, and Han Solo. Yoda's got a different name. His name in her version is Minch. Luke has a hidden sister. Luke's father is still a distinct character from Darth Vader. And Han Solo, at the end of the script, he leaves to search for his uncle, who apparently is the most powerful man in the universe other than the Emperor Palpatine. But as one Star Wars film expert put it, most importantly, you see that Brackett's draft, while definitely in need of a rewrite and several tweaks, holds all of the big moments we'd eventually see on screen. So we close this episode of The Far Middle by remembering a trailblazing legend of sci-fi and film, one whose resume brings back memories and nostalgia that spans generations of readers and moviegoers. Rest in peace, Lee Brackett. And no matter what planet or galaxy you visit this week, may the Force be with you, and always stay connected to that far middle.